Today on Maine Calling, new thinking and new treatments for obesity. The most recent data shows that more than 40% of Americans are considered obese, and that's the case in Maine as well. It is a major public health problem because obesity is linked to other dangerous conditions: heart disease, diabetes, stroke, liver disease, kidney disease, and infertility among them. But as anyone who has tried to lose weight knows, fighting obesity is extremely hard and complicated. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss the latest thinking about obesity, and we learn about the newest treatments, from semaglutides like Ozempic to bariatric surgery, and what they might mean for people who are struggling. We'll also address some of the stigma around obesity. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Obesity is often called the biggest public health concern of our time. Well, this is Obesity Care Awareness Week, and today we are going to learn about the latest approaches for managing obesity, including weight loss drugs, and we'll discuss what can be done about stigma tied to obesity. Joining me now, Dr. Mattia Burtis, who specializes in obesity medicine, preventative medicine, and women's health. She's the medical director of Maine Medical Center's Obesity Management Program for Adults. And Dr. Alan Brown is a retired pediatric surgeon and now an educator on pediatric obesity. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you tried different ways to lose weight? Curious about the pros and cons of weight loss drugs? Baffled as to why nothing seems to work? Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both so much for joining us. And Dr. Burtis, I'll start with you by asking you, you know, I know that there are people listening to this program right now, rolling their eyes and saying, hey, we know it's calories in, calories out, people are eating too much processed food and not exercising enough. Tell us the truth. What are we learning about obesity?
Well, the way that we think about this disease has changed dramatically over the past decade. And that way of thinking in terms of calories in, calories out is really out the window. We really thought about it that way for a long time. And I can say that I worked in primary care for many, many years. And in fact, that was the advice that I gave many of my patients for many years. And it was hard for me, as we learned more about the science about this disease, to go back and say, you know, I was wrong. I was wrong about that. And what we know now is that this is a chronic medical condition, that obesity is a disease that is governed by an elevated fat mass set point and an abnormal energy regulatory system. And that this disease needs to be treated just like any other chronic medical condition, with effective medical treatment.
Dr. Brown, I think a lot of people blame processed food because they notice that there are more people obese today than there used to be. You look at old black and white photos of, you know, people playing in Deering Oaks Park in Portland, and everyone seems slim. And so they say, oh, it's today's lifestyle. But then other people have suggested maybe it's microplastics, maybe it's preservatives in our food. Do we know why there's a surge in obesity?
The simple answer is no, but I think we're starting to close in on it. because now we're looking at the physiology of the disease, as Mattia mentioned, and regarding it that way and saying what in our environment, what in an individual's environment upsets that physiology, upsets the control system that is really driving our size and weight. Even though we think we can do it, we actually can't do it. Our control system does it. We can't control our blood pressure. We can't control our blood sugar, and we cannot control our body mass either. So we've done a lot of work looking at what I would call associations. And yes, if you look at people who have obesity, or if you take them to the NIH and put them in a room for 2 weeks and you feed them what's called ultra-processed food, it seems to be related in some way, but we don't know how it's really related. We also know that the plastics leak what are called estrogen disruptors, and we know that estrogen disruptors are very much involved in energy regulation. So we're slowly putting that part together. Now, the good news that Mattia and I can bring today is that in spite of not knowing what's causing it, what we do know now over the past 20 years or so is how to control the disease and approach it as a disease and use the medical management that we're learning about.
Well, Mattia, let me turn to you for that. If a patient comes to you and has struggled with his or her weight and wants to start thinking about maybe some of these new approaches that we've heard about, whether it's bariatric surgery, whether it's a semaglutide drug, where do you start with this patient? How do you talk to this patient? What are you looking at and thinking about?
That's a really good question, Jennifer. What we know about the disease of obesity is it looks really different in different people. And, you know, there's a lot of genes that are responsible for this disease. There's really, truly hundreds. And that's why it can look very different in different people. So my role is really to ask a lot of questions about how this disease plays out, and understand that some people may benefit from certain medications or surgery versus other people. And so we basically, in obesity medicine, try to categorize the obesity a little bit. We try to understand if someone is struggling more with their ability to feel fullness, or their ability to stay full, or if they're struggling with emotional eating, or if they're eating hardly anything, but their body just will not allow the weight to come off. So there are different situations for different people. And based on that conversation, that guides me to which treatment might be best, the best place to start.
Alan, you've worked with children, teenagers, and their parents for your entire life. And I want you to talk to me about what it's like to be an obese child, what it is like to be the parent of an obese child, and how you would address them, and how it's different than the traditional medical establishment would.
Well, first, I'd just like to say that it's the same disease, just a different patient. And that's a very important concept that people need to think about for a minute. I can't tell you what it's like to be an obese child because I've never been one. I've gotten to know a bunch of them. And when you get to know them, you find out that they're just a child. If I close my eyes and talk to the child, I can't tell you how much they weigh. And that's one of the unique parts about the disease of obesity, is that it's so visible. It's visible coming down the street. It's visible sitting in a chair. Traditionally, we all grew up in a culture which said, if you have problems with obesity, eat less and exercise more. And if you still have problems with obesity, it's your fault because you're not doing it right, or you're not doing it correctly. Turns out that's all wrong. I had to learn that. I think most people have had to learn that. This is, as Mattia pointed out, a disease, and it's a dysregulation of our energy regulatory system. Mothers take incredible heat. You can see this in Shaw's or Hannaford's. If they go through the checkout line and they've got potato chips, people start looking at them with these sour looks. How can you feed your child that? So mothers are a huge part of the puzzle of taking care of the child, because the mothers believe it and they think it's their fault, but it's not their fault. The kids think it's their fault, but it's not their fault. The kids are harassed in school, called bad names, bullied. They can't run as fast for sports. They're the last ones chosen quite frequently. So one of the big issues for the kids that's underappreciated, I think, is their quality of life and what they have to go through when they have this very visible problem. And so there are some unique aspects to the child with the disease of obesity.
Of course, this entire field of study has just been changed dramatically in the last couple of years with the advent of what's called semaglutides, the Ozempic and Wegovy's out there. And Dr. Brown, is this a treatment that's appropriate for young people, for children and teenagers, or do we even know yet?
Wonderful question and considerable debate, but I'm was trained as a pediatric surgeon and practiced for 40 years as a pediatric surgeon. And as a pediatric surgeon, I never asked the patient how old you were. I asked, can I help you? I've operated in the delivery suite. And so this age business is part of the bias and stigma that the families and children undergo. Our goal as physicians is to make the patient healthier. And if you make her healthier, that's good, no matter what age you're at. So the medications are being tested and watched very carefully to see if they have good effects or bad effects on growth and development. The best data we have actually is related to metabolic and bariatric surgery, which shows that a young child, 5, 6, 7 years old, who undergoes metabolic and bariatric surgery has a more normal growth pattern, has a more normal sexual maturation pattern. In other words, things that people worry about just don't happen because you're making them healthier. That's the trick. This is not starvation. This is changing the control system in their body. You don't use starvation to treat the disease of obesity.
You know, what you're saying might just seem like a really shocking thing to a lot of people, the idea of bariatric surgery to a young child. It's like, wow, how have we gotten to this place in society that this is needed? When you first started thinking about it, did it seem dramatic and sort of, I don't know, just did it take you a while to come to terms with that idea yourself, Dr. Brown?
Well, I think as a surgeon, and actually most of the treatments that we do in medicine have a bad side. And you have to look at all those treatments from a risk benefit point of view. So if you will, I've been treating sick people, sick children, and hurting them, if you will, with surgery. So I better have had a good reason. So I had to get to know and have a little light bulb go off in my brain about the disease of obesity. And that's what happened to me. The light bulb went off in my brain as I was listening to an adult bariatric surgeon talk about quality of life of his patients, patients who have difficulty in the bathroom, patients who can't put their clothes on, patients who can't get in a car. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. My kids have those same problems, the kids that I'm dedicated to helping improve their lives. Now, I've learned much more about the disease of obesity. There are actually over 200 complications that the kids are faced with throughout their lifespan. So I was right, but I am a sap about kids. I'm a champion of kids. And if they've got a problem and I can help them, I am going to try.
Dr. Burtis, you mentioned that for each patient, there may be a different approach. Who is somebody who might be a candidate for bariatric surgery? Who is somebody who might be a candidate for an Ozempic type of drug?
Yeah. So many patients can benefit from both. But the indication for metabolic surgery is that if someone has a body mass index of 35 with two or more cardiovascular comorbidities, or they have a BMI of over 40. So anybody in that range would certainly qualify for metabolic surgery. Many patients will these days are really looking to try a medication if they can, especially now that we do have medications that are pretty robust. And so what I'm finding is that people want to try a medication first. Now, if someone comes to see us and they have a much higher BMI, they're likely going to benefit from both. Sometime, and this is a chronic, progressive, incurable disease. So even when we do metabolic surgery, this disease progresses. So there are instances where we still need to use medication even after surgery. So it's not necessarily an either or, but a lot of times I think about this as maybe as more like disease burden. How severe is this disease? And perhaps that's when we start to look at more intense treatments.
Do you have problems having your patients either pay for or be covered for these treatments by their insurance companies?
That's a really good question. Yes, for sure. And this has been very difficult. Insurance doesn't always cover these medications. It has changed a lot. We are seeing more and more insurance companies covering these medications. More insurance companies are covering metabolic surgery. We sometimes need to prescribe some of these medications, and I'm not talking about the semaglutide. A lot of times these medications, the insurance companies categorically exclude any treatment for the disease of obesity in terms of pharmacotherapy. So we sometimes need to use old generic medications and break them up into two components and prescribe them in that way to allow for coverage. So we have to be pretty clever with the way that we're prescribing to be able to allow for patients to get the treatment that they need. But I can say that since I've been doing this for the past almost 20 years, it is improving. Even Medicare is starting to cover some of these medications with certain indications. So there have been changes as we've moved along. Maine Health covers these medications, and so there are big employers in our state that does cover anti-obesity medication.
We are talking about obesity and new treatments for it and new thinking about it. Our phone call, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, and if you send an email, please make it brief, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What does medicine know today about the reasons for obesity and how to treat it? My guest today, Dr. Alan Brown, who specializes in pediatric and adolescent weight management. He's a retired pediatric surgeon, focused now on education around this topic. And Dr. Mattia Bertis, who is a specialty in obesity medicine and medical director at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about the different ways to manage obesity? Are you worried about someone you love? Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to so many good questions already coming in. We'll go to one from Catherine. Isn't it difficult to find a fine line between telling someone it's not their fault that they're obese and that it's a disease, but still encouraging them to be proactive about a healthier diet and more exercise? Does reducing the blame give patients less incentive or an excuse not to push themselves to make lifestyle changes? And Dr. Bertis, you're grinning ear to ear.
This is a great question. I think a lot of times when I've given talks about this, I can see even physicians in the audience sort of cringing about the idea of removing responsibility, personal responsibility. But the answer to this question really is that when we treat the physiology, when we write the physiology, it is more encouraging to a person to actually lead a healthy lifestyle, because when they lead a healthy lifestyle, it works. So if you can imagine that you're always trying to work at this and do what is right, but you never ever see results because your physiology is working against you, and then all of a sudden you're given treatment for your physiology, and then it all of a sudden works. It's more encouraging, not less.
An email from Beth. Please ask your guests about sugar addiction as it relates to weight control. Dr. Brown, now you're the one grinning.
I'm just grinning because of the, it's a great question, and it's an opening to the history of the treatment of obesity and of diets over the last 50 or 60 years. We've had carbohydrates take a rap. We've had fats take a rap. We've had sugar take a rap. Currently, we're after microplastics and that sort of stuff getting into our food. Unfortunately, it's just not that simple. And when your body is trying to keep you at an unhealthy weight, you will eat more sugar. We also do have more sugar in our diets than we've ever had before, just to be kind of a treat. But the manufacturers have used it as a leader or an enticement. But it's just not that simple. You have to start out with saying, wait a minute, there is an energy control system in my body. And that energy control system is disturbed probably by many different factors, one of them being what we eat. But also stress and sleep and our own genetics. So for each person, what's bumping their energy control system is different. These are some of the things we're going to be learning over the next 10 to 20 years as we focus our therapies. Our therapies right now are a little bit shotgun, if you will, because we don't understand the disease well enough yet. We understand that it is a disease, but as we understand the different effects, the different environmental effects, the different genetic predispositions, then we'll be able to be much more accurate with our therapies.
And just to be clear, neither one of you is saying, don't eat vegetables, don't eat whole grains, don't eat lean protein and sit on your bum all day. You're saying still do these things, but don't expect those to be the things that combats obesity, correct? I'll go to you, Dr. Brutus.
That's correct. I mean, leading a healthy lifestyle is not something that is advice that is exclusive for the disease of obesity. We would give that same advice to every single person, but it is not necessarily an intervention for the treatment of this disease.
We'll go to Sal, who's calling from Bridgeton. Hi, Sal, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, but you need to turn down your radio.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Oh, sorry about that. No, I was just, I think you might have covered it already, but how about exercise? I don't know. It seems like kids these days are sitting around a lot just because there's so much, you know, there's TV, there's the computer, there's everything, and they're more prone to just be sitting a lot. I mean, it seems like it's a, you know.
Yeah, Sal, no, it's a good question. Yeah, and I'll turn to Alan Brown about this. There have been lots of studies done, Dr. Brown, about how much time kids spend in front of screens, how little time they spend outside, how little time at school is given to recess anymore, physical education. Is this part of the whole problem?
Perhaps. But I think it's, from a causative point of view, a relatively minor part of the whole problem. I'd look at it the other way around. If the child has developed obesity, they don't feel like getting out of the chair because they weigh 200, 300, 400 pounds. if they go out to play basketball, they don't get chosen to play because they weigh 200, 300, 400 pounds. So there's a lot of negative. You can take that and spin it on itself. And more importantly is what's going on with that energy regulatory system. What are the things, and as I was mentioning before, what are the things that are affecting that energy regulatory system? Medications are a big one. As a matter of fact, we've learned to go over the medications that patients are on because some of those medications actually are aggravating the problem of the obesity.
Go ahead, Dr. Burrs.
I just wanted to add to that, you know, leading a more sedentary lifestyle can contribute to obesity, you know, in that it does also cause some insulin resistance, and we definitely do see that. But on the flip side, once you have the disease of obesity, increasing the physical activity doesn't always then treat the disease. So we have to start to detangle what causes might be contributing to causes and what we might use to treat the disease. And so that's the part that oftentimes does get confused with everyone.
Go ahead, Dr. Brown.
Let me also stress that healthy living is so important, whether you have the disease of obesity or you don't. I mean, it's part of being healthy. So, matter of fact, if you want to talk about diets, the diet becomes very much more important when you're controlling your obesity because you're not eating as much and you have to be more selective about what you eat. It also is much easier for you to be active. So they are intertwined, just as Mattia says. And there's a disease, it's bad for health, and then there's healthy living. Healthy living is for everybody.
A message here from Lee. It seems that BMI has become this grade that people get that is used to determine so many things, whether it's the kind of treatment someone should get, what insurance will cover. It's even used by workplaces to decide whether an employee qualifies for some kind of bonus for being healthy or not. Is that one number, that one way of measuring, really that definitive? Mattia, talk to us about BMI. Boy, is that controversial.
Yeah, it's really controversial. I think it gives us something to go by, and it's easily measurable. I think that insurance companies love it because it's a way to cost contain. You can always lean into that. But, you know, I mean, someone can have a high muscle mass and have a high BMI and not really have meet the criteria for obesity that someone else does. So there are, you know, more physiologic ways to look at this, but they're more costly. So we don't necessarily do it. I mean, to really look at, to really look at lean muscle mass and excess body fat, and to really be able to understand this disease, we would have to be doing DEXA scans on everyone, and we don't necessarily do that. And so it gives us an inexpensive way of looking at it, but it is by far not perfect.
It's a starting point, right?
It is. It truly is.
Starting point's a good way to look at it. It's a screener.
Yeah.
But then the healthcare provider needs to look at that patient, because you can have a low BMI, but the fat tissue's in the wrong place, and you're going to have obesity-related complications. This is an ethnic phenomena for some people in certain parts of the world. So that BMI gets a rap by people who'd like to do that sort of stuff, but actually it's a very useful number, as Mattia said, and we know a lot about what it says, but we also know a lot about what it doesn't say, and that's where the healthcare provider has to step in and say, who are you? And individualize things to the individual.
An email here from Eddie. If consuming fewer calories than you burn, granting short of starvation, does not reduce fat, then how is the fat maintained? Mattia, I'll go to you.
Okay. If consuming, say this again, if consuming
she says,
fewer.
He says, if consuming fewer calories does not reduce fat, then how is the fat maintained? And I think what he's asking is, if you're consuming fewer calories and not losing weight, then how does that, why?
So your body will, it is a phenomenon. So you're so so you're not so so the idea is you're not reduce you're not eating enough, but your body is holding on to the fat. That is something that happens. And so your body will preserve that is part of this disease, and that your body will hold on to this fat. You might reduce your muscle mass because you're not eating enough calories, so you're not healthy in this way, but your body will hold on to your fat, and that is it defends the fat. That's part of this disease.
I need to ask, step back a little bit and ask, how does this new class of drugs or this new family of drugs work? Why is it that I think you, I've been saying semaglutide, but you pronounce it a little differently, Dr. Burtis. We know that it maybe reduces hunger, but it's more than that, right?
Yeah. So this class of medicine is a class of medicine that is focused on treating the intestinal hormones. So when you have the disease of obesity, we know that people with this disease have lower levels of some of the intestinal hormones. And because of that, at their natural base, at someone's natural baseline with this disease, one can feel more hungry, not stay full in between meals. And when these hormones are at a normal level, that's very different. We know with a metabolic bariatric surgery that a lot of these hormones normalize after metabolic surgery. And so we learned that there's a change with when there's a change with these hormones, weight tremendously decreases. So as we treat with these medications that alter these hormones to more normal levels for people, we then see that the weight starts to come off. So, what these medications do is they allow us to use our hormones, which are naturally low with this disease, in a much better way. And that helps the weight to come off. So we stay full sooner. There are hormones, receptors for these hormones in our brain. So we register fullness sooner. We have less cravings. It's pretty remarkable.
Alan Brown, are there any anything we know that would be reasons not to use one of these medications?
Oh yes, there are contraindications, and some people just don't tolerate them, but the intolerance is usually on the basis of nausea and adapting to how fast to eat and what foods to eat. So actually, the tolerances are pretty amazing. But there is some laboratory evidence, not people evidence, but laboratory evidence that these hormones are related to some types of tumors. And so we'd have to screen the patient and the patient's family for types of tumors. If the patient's had a history of some diseases like pancreatitis, we have to be very careful in using some of these hormones. So it's like any other treatment. There's pros and cons and goods and bads, and the patient has to be carefully evaluated to see if they are a candidate. Now, I say that, which sounds really scary, but it turns out that if you take 1,000 people, most people are candidates. So that list is very important for us to consider. But on the other hand, it's rather remarkable because compared to other medications we've had come on the market, you'll see them on TV, we don't have that long list of problems.
And Mattia, now that even though these are so in such widespread use, they are really, really new. Is there any sort of risk to that in general that so many people are taking something that's so new?
Well, we've been using this class of medication for diabetes for over a decade. So we're pretty familiar with this class of medications. And so the individual agents are new, but the use of these types of medications is not that new. So I guess as a physician, I'm not thinking of them as new, for that reason. I think that it's become new in the public eye because there has been somewhat of an awakening with it. But I think that the comfort level with using these medications is there for providers in our community.
Alan.
Jennifer, your question is extremely good. And of course, in the pediatric age group, it's even more, well, it has its own considerations. I mean, the children need to live their whole life. And it's unusual to watch somebody for 100 years before you're going to okay a treatment. So we're looking at it. We know the kids are healthier by all the measurements that we've are able to do so far. But it's going to be very important for there to be support for long-term studies and for these patients to be carefully monitored to make sure that there aren't long-term effects sometimes later in their life.
We're talking about obesity and new ways to manage this. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. As obesity affects rising numbers of children and adults in America, we're learning about some of the newer approaches to help them lose weight and also looking at how our society views obesity. Joining me, Dr. Mattia Bertis, who's an obesity specialist with Maine Medical Center, and Dr. Alan Brown, who is a retired pediatric surgeon who now has his life work obesity education. Share your comments and questions. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. An email here from Charlotte. I'm disappointed in your so-called experts on causes of obesity, which is a worldwide problem. The man said you can't control your blood sugar, which is absolutely false. You can do so with the proper diet. Well, there are so many additional factors for obesity. The biggest factor is what you eat. Do they own stock in the obesity drugs? Dr. Brown, you go first.
Great debate. And I think that given some time and showing this lady some of the evidence that we have about the existence of the energy regulatory system, I could change her mind. It's an interesting story because the story actually starts at the Jackson Labs in Bar Harbor, Maine, where they found a mouse that was congenitally had the disease of obesity. But there's no doubt that there is an energy regulatory system, and it's not something that we as conscious human beings control. It's subconscious, and it's doing things subconsciously, and we have to kind of come to grips with that because we've lived most of our lives and in our culture thinking that we could control it and all we had to do was eat less and exercise more. I had to change my whole thinking about it, and I still work on it so that I'm not surprised that she has strong feelings.
We'll go to Mandy calling from Bethel. Hi, Mandy. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a quick question about prevention being the best cure. We've heard that so many times with so many different illnesses. I know that the speakers today are focused on and experience with patients who are already obese. So at that point, it's too late for prevention. But what if some of their clients want to start a family? And maybe there's some suspicion that their children may, you know, likely become obese. Is their research and is their focus, and there should there be focus more on situations like the one I just described and overall with society and with a lot more at the prevention level so we can change our culture in a big way moving forward? Thank you.
Go ahead, Alan.
The answer is yes. But the problem is that over the past 50 years or so, we haven't figured it out, how to talk to a family and say, if you do this, this, and this, your children will not be affected by the disease of obesity. And we all have families that come in, and one, they've been worrying about failure to thrive, and the other one, they've been worried about the disease of obesity. It's a fickle thing. And right now, as a matter of fact, we're better at treating the disease than we are at preventing the disease. Although actually there's some recent data that shows things may be leveling off in terms of the incidence of the disease, whether that's susceptibility, we're just filling up catching all the ones who are susceptible, or whether we're, some of our things that we're talking about with healthy living are having an effect is unclear. But I my think that there are other environmental factors that we just have to.
Oh, shoot. Dr. Brown, you just froze up on your Zoom. We'll go to, okay, you're back. We'll go to Ben, who's calling from Auburn. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm a retired doctor, and I think it's very important for people to know the numbers. These numbers are rounded for easy remembering. The average person burns about 2,400 calories per day. That's about 100 per hour. And in order to lose significant weight, you have to increase the number of calories that you burn. It's difficult to burn 100 calories in an hour when you're exercising. That requires a fair amount of effort, and that only increases your metabolic burn by about 5% per day, and that won't lose you much weight. I'd like to hear what the experts say about that. My point is that it's very difficult to lose weight by exercising. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So even if somebody, you know, runs 5 miles a day, you're burning, what, 500 calories? Mati, I'll go to you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's just the, and we, if we all had the same energy regulatory system, we might be able to do calculations like that. And I think we have a lot of different apps that do different calculations. But what's difficult is that your energy, the energy regulatory system for people who have this disease is really aberrant, and it really has changed. And, you know, and especially when people have dieted over and over and over again, every single time someone who has the disease of obesity does a very restrictive diet, they take a hit to their energy regulatory system. Their basal metabolic rate falls when they do restrictive dieting and they lose weight. And then their body starts to fight back and that weight comes back. But what happens is that metabolic rate does not rebound with the weight. So over time, people start to relegate their body to a lower caloric intake just to maintain. So yes, it is hard to lose weight with exercising, but it is really hard to lose weight with exercising when you also have an energy regulatory system that is not working correctly.
Ben, thanks so much for your call. An email here from Lynn. How long does one have to take a weight loss drug? Is it lifelong or decades long or case specific, but with an end date? Really important question. I'll go back to you, Mattia.
It's forever. So what we know about this disease is it's a chronic medical condition. So just like high blood pressure, just like high cholesterol, these medications need to be taken forever because we don't right this road. We don't have a way to cure obesity. So if someone stops taking these medications, then these levels of these hormones in the intestines just go back to the way that they were and the weight comes back.
I'll go to William calling from Bridgeton. Hi, William. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wondering what percentage of overweight people are overweight because of lack of exercise and diet, and what percentage really needs to do the drugs, because I see a lot of people that are heavy eating just ridiculous amounts of food.
I'm going to go back to you. I'll go to you, Dr. Brown. Do we know the answer to that?
Yeah, we do. You have to put things in sequence. And the sequence isn't lack of activity and food. The sequence is an abnormal energy regulatory system that says you should have a different body composition that then drives you to that unhealthy level and then defends that unhealthy level. So that if you look at attempts by persuading people to eat a little less and exercise more, that will work to a small degree. In other words, by that I mean less than 5% of their body weight, in maybe 10% of people. Well, that's just not very good therapy for a disease where to get a good effect on health, you need to lose 20 or 30% of your body weight. And you want more than one out of 10 people responding. So I think that that we do know why it doesn't work. It's because you're treating the wrong thing. You have to treat the energy regulatory system, and you have to move that set point.
Dr. Burtis.
You know, I don't think we know the percentage of people that are in one category versus the other, but what I can say is that the longer someone struggles with this disease, the more likely it sets in. And it's not just a matter of somebody gained, gained 5 or 10 pounds and they just need to kind of cut back and get moving again. It's when this disease, when this has been going on for a long time and it's really, they try to lose weight and they're doing everything right and they're finding that the weight is still there or it's coming back in spite of best efforts. And then that tells us that this is just not working. It's not making sense. And I think that a person's instincts when they're seeing that in their body, that's this disease playing out and it's real.
William, thanks for your call. Let's see, we'll go to Anne calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. So I have an observation. I'm 67 going on 68. When I was a kid or even, I don't know, the epidemic, we're calling it, of obesity has not been a thing until about the last, 30 years or so. And calling it a disease, I'm not so sure about that. So can you speak to the change in body habitus over the decades?
Anne, thanks for your question. And I'll go back to you, Dr. Burtis. Couple questions there. And one that we haven't addressed yet is this idea of calling obesity a disease. Even within the medical community, there's some debate about whether you should use the word disease, right?
It is. Although the American Medical Association in 2013 defined it as a disease. And so using all the research that has come to light, and to the point of the fact that we now have a whole body of information that has defined a discipline in medicine called obesity medicine, we now understand it as a chronic medical condition. And so we didn't understand it this way before. We thought of it more as a personal failing. But now we do understand it as a whole host of metabolic consequences that define this disease. And so, but it is hard for people to talk about it that way. And we could call it a medical condition instead of a disease. I think we can mince our words, but it's, it's been since 2013 that it's been defined this way, and it's taken this long for people to grapple with it.
Anne, thanks for your question. And earlier in the program, we did talk about how we're not really sure. Medicine's not really sure why we're seeing such an increase. A lot of potential reasons for this. Dr. Burtis, I'm going to turn back to you. We talked a little bit about the bias and stigma and what people who, I mean, clearly all you have to do is watch the Academy Awards and know that in our culture, thin is in. But I'm wondering about how that gets in the way of people seeking help themselves, coming to you in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people who have this disease, there's a lot of internalized bias. And a lot of people with the disease of obesity do not seek medical care. It takes a lot to come in and to talk about this. And when they do seek care, they're often blamed for their disease or everything that they're complaining about is put on obesity as the problem. And so they are frequently discounted. And so there's a lot of distrust with the medical community for people who have this disease. And so it's really hard. And there's a lot of, besides internalized bias, there's a lot of just generalized judgment in the general public. And most people in the general public have a strong opinion about this disease. I'm there's 6,000 specialists in this field, and I'm amazed at how many I meet at a cocktail party, because everyone seems to know exactly how this disease should be treated. And so it really is remarkable in that way. But it's, you know, we're trying to change it. And one of the things that, Jennifer, I just wanted to say is we're trying to shift from saying, from calling a person obese to saying a person with obesity. And so just that slight change makes a big difference, because it is a, you know, it really creates, it separates the disease from the person.
Boy, we could keep talking about this. So interesting. I really appreciate the time both of you have given us. The voice you just heard, Dr. Mattia Bertis, who specializes in obesity medicine and is medical director at Maine Medical Center's Obesity Management Program for Adults. Also with us for the hour, Dr. Alan Brown, a retired pediatric surgeon who now is an educator about obesity and obesity treatment. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we'll learn about young inventors in Maine and how students today are taught to innovate and solve problems. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.